I'm going to take us to 1978. This man may not look like it, but he had a lot of concerns. He was just about to graduate from his master's in engineering at Stanford, and he didn't know what he was going to do next. He'd really appreciated the camaraderie, the collaboration, the prototyping, solving technical challenges at Stanford, and he didn't want to let that go. He didn't want to go back into a corporate environment. He didn't think of himself as a business person or an entrepreneur, but he didn't see a choice. So he started a product design company that became IDEO. He had gotten to know Steve Jobs during his time at Stanford, and early on, he actually landed a contract to design the first commercial mouse for the Lisa computer. It put IDEO on the map. And this is the GRID, the first commercial laptop. Who's seen this before? A couple people, it's better than normal. But this was not a commercial success. You might be able to imagine why. I think that phone jammed on the side is one example of a lot of technology jammed into this device, a lot of expensive technology at the time. And it drove it up to a price that wasn't needed. It didn't have a point of view of what it was about and what needs it was causing for what might be as a solution for people. This woman, Jane Fulton Surrey, felt she had the answer. She wanted IDEO teams to actually spend time with their customers, learning about their needs, learning about their pain points, and then only once they understood that to start designing a solution for them. And that wasn't actually met initially with warm welcome. A lot of the engineers and designers at IDEO, they just wanted to jump in. They wanted to start working on solutions. But after a year, this actually proved out. It was made a part of every single project at IDEO to make sure that they understood consumers before they got designing. This was starting to be called human-centered design, and in 1999, ABC Nightline got a hold of it, and they wanted to do a piece on it. And in IDEO fashion, we decided to show rather than tell. And over a three-day period, we dove into doing research, prototyping, ideation, and the like, designing a high-resolution prototype by the end of what the future of the shopping cart would be. And it went as viral as something could go in the 90s. This is actually now used in education around the world, and almost all MBA schools use the shopping cart video to teach design to budding business people. And there was an interesting byproduct of this, which is that a lot of people saw the potential of how human-centered design could be applied to different challenges. And so IDEO was starting to ask to do different types of work. And it started closer in at first, retail design, brand design, and the like. But it soon expanded, solving social challenges, launching new ventures. And we realized that we needed new and different types of people to do that work and different type of skill sets working in this highly collaborative design-like environment. And this is where my story starts at IDEO. I'm David Aiken. That's me over there on the left, business designer. In 2005, Tim Brown, our CEO, decided that we needed more business-savvy people working side-by-side with designers at their pace. I had a background in mechanical engineering. I was a self-taught designer. I had two startups under my belt and an MBA, and I was chosen to be part of the three-person founding team. So we dove in. We started first refining out IDEO's strategy offering. Then we started working at the same pace of designers, the quick pace that they sketched to develop business models and financial models and ensure that the business concept was evolving alongside the experience concept. We then set our sights on prototyping. So instead of just prototyping experiences and products, we backed up and looked at the bigger picture. And we said, what are the biggest assumptions underlying any new solution? And let's actually focus our prototyping efforts on that and make sure that we're de-risking our business model as we build it. I took over business design about 3 years in, and I led it for about 7 years, taking from about 7 designers globally to about 50, about 10% of our design community, which is about where it is at today. In 2005, Tim Brown made another suggested change to IDEO. We had always been about impact through design, and in that year, he added disproportionate. And sorry, that was 2015, not 2009. You had a disproportionate, so disproportionate impact through design. And they came with an explicit challenge. It wasn't just about design consulting. It wasn't about design team spending time with a client team and working on new product solutions, organizational solutions, and the like. It was about leveraging products, services, and networks to actually scale IDEO's knowledge and expertise. And I was put in charge of a new products team with the charter of helping leaders build more creative organizations. We didn't know what those products or solutions were going to be yet, but we had dozens of ideas, and we went out into the field, and we tested them. We looked at leaders and saw what they might want or need. And we saw that a lot of them were really confused about where they stood. You know, they were starting to make efforts to build innovative organizations and creative teams. They didn't know if they were doing well or not. And what's more, they didn't know where to focus. And so as a result, we saw two things. One is that they would spend their time too distributive ways, working on too many different things, none of them with significant resources or attention. And as a result, change didn't really take hold. On the other side, it would lead to paralysis. So people would discuss what might be done next, but they actually never got anything done. So we designed a tool that would figure out what were the metrics and what were the activities that organizations could do to increase their performance, given where they stand, and help them focus on the areas that were most likely to move the needle. So to start with a study, we gathered information across dozens of, and then hundreds of different teams and business units, looking at hundreds of different variables about what make them tick and which are correlated with high performance. The main metric, and I'll come back to this a few times, are successful launches. So when teams set out with a particular goal and the project team has the goal to fulfill that, what's the likelihood that something comes out of the end that actually is successfully implemented? In some of those cases, it was a new venture or a new product, something market-facing. In a bunch of those solutions, they were also internal, streamlining operations or modernizing the way internal systems work. We identified dozens of factors that have a material impact on performance and successful launches, and they all rolled up under six creative qualities. And it's these qualities that I want to talk to you all about today. So let's dive into the first one. The first one is purpose. It's really hard to figure out what to do and to put energy in if you don't actually know the change that you're trying to make in the world. And we see this at a lot of organizations. It's not that there's lack of opportunities or lack of ideas. It's that they have a lack of a way to choose. So there's a number of factors that are really important about purpose. The first is that it's clear, that everyone at the organization understands it. We see at points a company might come up with a new mission statement or a new vision, and it gets sort of put into a memo, and people forget about it a few weeks later. It needs to be clear, it needs to be repeated, it needs to be made tangible. Next, it needs to be something that helps make decisions. A purpose is useless if you can't say, this is for a purpose and this is against it. So people need to be able to look at initiatives and say which ones actually are higher priority and that they better help us achieve our purpose. And even as we go and design that, what are the features and the nuances of it that lean us more towards that purpose? And finally, great purposes actually ignite people. They inspire them to take action, and that purpose can be aligned with many, if not all, of an employee's personal purpose. That helps them bring better judgment to work. It helps them engage and be energized to do their work. To talk about, a statistic. So a lot of people think this is soft stuff. But what we see is that when organizations are clear about their purpose and then they keep it consistent for years rather than just months or kind of goes with the wind, those teams are 20% more likely to have successful launches. So material impact on performance. And to talk about purpose, I'm going to take us to Europe and Berlin particularly, and to Zalando. Zalando is the biggest e-commerce provider in Europe, and they started really without too much purpose. They saw the success of Zappos in the United States and rising e-commerce companies in Asia, and they realized nothing similar actually existed in Europe, and that was largely because of the challenges of working across European borders. And they decided to tackle that challenge head on, and within 2 years, they had a massive e-commerce company well on its way to becoming the largest in Europe. They started to see where that potential would tack about. They already had great penetration in the European market. And this is when they started to debate, what do we do next? Do we start going into different markets? Do we start launching new ventures? Do we start expanding our portfolio? And they were in these constant discussions about what to do. So they engaged IDEO to think about that. And we realized that they kind of lacked the criteria to choose. And so we set on a project of trying to identify their purpose. And we started as we normally do. We talked to some executives. We talked to some people. We started to get some provocations. And we put this into a two-day event at which engaged everyone at Zalando to have a dialogue around purpose. One of the displays was this timeline you see here where people could post their proudest moments in Zalando's history and vote for them with those little orange Zalando logo stickers. Other displays had sort of visual representations of these provocations of what might the purpose be, complete with audio stories. And all of these stations invited feedback and dialogue with people across Zalando. Two things emerged. One is that Zalando had really become a fashion company, and people were really proud of that. That timeline had a huge cluster around the time when they first launched some of their own fashion lines, and people had seen others on the street wearing those designs. It had truly become a fashion company, and people were really excited to see that go forward. On the other side, they realized, and a lot of people had joined this company as a small startup, and they realized Zalando was no longer a startup. It was a massive corporation with a big footprint on Europe and the planet. And they were concerned about what the company would do about that. Are we just going to be part of the problem? Do we actually care about our impact? The outcome was a new purpose that brought those two elements together, reimagining fashion for the good of all. And it was explicit that it was going to double down on the fashion side. It was going to get faster fashion, be able to follow trends more quickly and meet the needs of more niche markets in Europe. At the same time, it was going to minimize waste as it did that. And it deployed dozens of projects using AI to seek out inefficiencies in their supply chain. There's dozens of projects now underway in the interest of fast fashion, but also in the interest of minimizing or zeroing out their footprint on the planet. So the first thing, obviously, if you're feeling a lack of purpose, is to try to put one together. And it's often there. It's the reason that people chose the industry, if not the company. Hopefully it has some more unique factor to that for a particular organization. But then where most organizations fall short is to keep using that purpose as a decision maker, always particularly at the project selection or the big picture stage. You shouldn't be doing anything unless it's actually aligned with the purpose. And then even as those decisions get made, through a micro level, come back to it as a touch point. The next creative quality is looking out. So once you know where you want to go, you need to deeply understand that space. It's about a number of things. One, probably more obviously, is understand your customers, what their needs are, what their pain points are, what their hopes and dreams are. Next, you got to understand your market. That a lot of companies do moderately well. And the third is to understand technologies. And those technologies don't always exist in your market. They can exist in other places. They may not exist in any market yet. But understanding how they might affect or disrupt you is extremely important. We see that so many organizations, all the sensors and energy get turned inwards, right? It's so easy. All of that is in your face, you know, trying to coordinate to get things done, following protocol, dealing with internal operations. It's all right in front of you, so it's really easy to pay attention. You have to intentionally make time and effort to go out in the world and bring the new in. We see that when teams actually spend at least once a month going out in the world, getting new inspiration and bringing that to their colleagues and teammates, those teams are 25% more likely to have successful launches. To talk about looking out, I want to take us to LA County. LA County is the biggest voting population in the United States. There's 5 million registered voters there. And they have a system that hasn't been rehauled since 1960. So that's almost 60 years without a major improvement. And LA County had made their top priority to make voting accessible and intuitive for their diverse population. So that means people with vision impairment, the hearing impaired, people with learning disabilities, people who don't speak English, all these people needed to be able to vote. It was a pretty overwhelming challenge. It deals with regulators, legal advisors, dozens of different technical vendors. So how could we all bring them together and try and create a common vision of what we're solving? So as we do with most projects at IDEO, we started by looking out. We started by talking to the citizens of LA County to try to understand what their needs and frustrations had been. And since I think this is usually way more powerful when it's from people's mouths, I'm going to play a couple of audio clips here.
I don't like to use this word often, but I didn't want to be a burden on somebody else, and I wanted to do it myself. So I just said, I don't want to get into that and being blind. But yet, based on reports from other blind people that voted, they voted about the difficulties in, you know, getting the poll workers to help them out, you know, and how they just kind of move along, you know, got to get the next person in there. I didn't want to experience that.
Hopefully, you know, the people that helped, they were people that I didn't know. And presumably, you know, they were honest, and most people are honest. And, you know, I assumed that they marked what I intended them to mark, but I don't have a way to verify it.
So these are real stories, and they really touched the team. I mean, Ernie at the top hadn't actually gone to vote since that experience he described 20 years ago. So this gelled in, it not only provided ideas and really tangible ideas of what we were solving for and who we were solving for, but it also inspired empathy. You really wanted to help these people across all of these teams. So the End Solution is a pretty beautiful device. It makes affordances for all different types of people to be able to vote. It's modular, so the pieces can be swapped out as technology updates. But the thing that I think is most interesting about this is a feature that wouldn't have come out without the Looking Out. And there was an insight that basically people were inspired to vote at a particular moment when they heard a candidate speak to them through some way. And it spoke to the needs of them and their family. And that was the moment when they were really inspired to vote. Well, today we generally have to wait till election day to vote. But with the new LA County app, they can actually cast their vote in that moment. And it changes the mental equation for waiting till voting day to vote to, I've already cast my vote and I'm waiting to submit it. And it's very different psychologically. And we believe it'll radically increase the voter turnout in 2020. We'll have to wait and see for that. So if you're not used to Looking Out, it's nice to get started small. Like, think about three very different type of people who are dealing with a problem that you're trying to solve. They may be outside of your company, they could be inside your organization. And spend, you know, half an hour to 45 minutes just watching them conduct their activities in that space and then talking to them about how they felt. We always see people end up inspired and they end up with new ideas. So when people get Looking Out, it causes kind of a new problem. It's not really a problem, but there's a lot of ideas. And when you're particularly a big organization, you can end up with hundreds, thousands of different ideas coming from people all across the organization. And a lot of companies are just like, well, we just can't deal with that. You know, like, fill out your business model, do some really deep analysis, and come back with a really complete picture. Well, actually, the great ideas, great organizations actually use experimentation to get there. They are able to take people's intuition and find really cheap and inexpensive ways to explore those and narrow them down fairly, meritocratically, transparently, and then invest more in higher resolution experiments and prototypes until they get to their big investments. And this is one of my favorite stats that came out. There's a lot of excitement about sort of lean startup approaches today, and there's a lot that's really great about that. We borrow a lot from it. But this sort of launch and learn mentality of just get one guess, one hypothesis, one prototype out in the world and iterate it is not the most productive way. And you compare that to when organizations actually go out with five or more different ideas in parallel and evaluate it, those teams are actually 50% more likely to have a successful launch. There's two main reasons for this. The first one, I don't like the name of it, it's called cognitive laziness. It's not really about being lazy, it's actually just about how our brains are wired. And if you spend a few hours with your idea, your brain starts to go into a defensive mode. As much as you try to stay free and unbiased about it, you're not. And within days, you're truly not unbiased. The next is feedback. You get way worse feedback on one idea. We're social animals, and people like to please. And as much as someone thinks they're a straight shooter or the like, they're going to find some nice things to say. It's going to make you feel more optimistic about that one idea than you might if they were on a more fair playing field. You have multiple ideas. You can see where people's energy really goes and where their eyes light up and where they don't. To talk about experimentation, I'm going to take us to a startup, or no longer a startup, but recently a startup, called PillPack that we work closely with. And their founder, TJ, had been a kind of a small town pharmacist, and he had this idea to provide rolls of pills packaged neatly by the time and the day of which ones go together, to reduce error in pill taking and make it really easy for people to figure out what they should be taking when, and take the make it much more convenient by delivering this to people's home. He engaged IDEO to actually help with his go-to-market. How would he make this a business? How would he launch it? How would he market it? And the suggestion when we started was to do a pretty deep, in-depth market study. Create a survey, find a panel, send it out, do a lot of analysis. And that stuff is valuable. We do endorse that kind of study at times. But we're at day one, and we encourage him for just $1,700 to set up this booth outside of JCPenney, print out some materials, print out these little postcards of different value propositions and price points, and just test it, see what people come up with. Well, the first thing that happened is virtually no one actually went up to the booth. So the team got out from out, and they actually started to try and do some intercepts. And the first thing that was clear is that people didn't want to talk about their medication in a mall. But especially so because they didn't realize that this was actually a pharmacy. We thought it was some whiz-bang startup or some sort of packaging company that was going to get in between you and your pharmacy, and they wanted nothing to do that. Well, great. So we're a day into experimenting, and we go back and we make some new materials about switching pharmacies, about being a pharmacy. And a few more people came back. I mean, we still knew a mall wasn't the right place, so it wasn't, you know, people weren't lining up or anything. But we did see from the people who were interested and were coming up, it was never for them. It was like, oh, this would be great to put in my kid's lunchbox. They're always losing their pills. They have no convenient way to get them all together. Or they had the inconvenience of having to go to the pharmacy for a loved one. All these needs that were caretaker needs. And so the second day, and we have a second insight. The real customer is actually the caretaker, not the pill taker. A lot has happened since then, but those two insights have actually stayed true for the 4 years that PillPack has been in business. And it's been growing essentially by marketing based on those two pillars. And what's more, TJ was really influenced by this to the point that he's really instilled experimentation in the culture at PillPack. So everyone there is really empowered to ask questions, particularly about that first 90 days that are so important for building trust and loyalty. And as a result, they've had exponential growth. They're now fulfilling millions of prescriptions a year and have off the charts retention and net promoter score. So a little suggestion here that's handy is that people have that idea and they think it's an aha thing, and it might be, but I really encourage anyone, when you've got that idea you think is great, think about the problem it's trying to solve and come up with three, maybe four other ideas that could solve that solution, and actually use those and go out and test those ideas and experiment with those. Maybe your idea is great and you're going to have much better evidence that shows it, but you're going to get much better feedback and spend your energy in the right places. So once you have an idea with some potential, it actually takes a lot of different types of people to do it. We see that a lot of organizations, they have a particular technical skill set that really is foundational and important, and they need to hire a lot of those people, and that's great. However, what often happens is those people pervade into every type of role, and you actually need different people with different backgrounds and different types of roles to get those jobs done. This is where collaboration comes in. Having a good, diverse perspectives, mindsets, backgrounds, and skill sets. And it's not just having them, it's actually how they work together. We see that a lot of teams are much more in a waterfall approach. You know, first it's going to be, you know, strategy, then it's going to be design, then it's going to be finance. And if they are synchronizing, they're synchronizing weekly or monthly. But we see when the functions are working in parallel together at the same time and synchronizing daily, those teams are almost 40% more likely to have a successful launch. To demonstrate an extreme example of that, I'm going to take it kind of close to home here. CoLab is IDEO's R&D group, and for that we mean research and design. And we think of this kind of unholy alliance of all these different types of organizations and people that aren't really supposed to be working together. We've got healthcare organizations, financial services, hardware companies, startups, hackers, students, coming together, working on interesting challenges on technologies that are still at the edge and haven't really found their place in society, and just kind of play around with what are the different use cases that we can put together with all these different parties working together. And a couple years ago, a group with a background in financial services, hardware, and energy came together and were thinking, well, what if we could put renewable energy certificates on blockchain and create a solar panel solution that would actually manage its own distribution of energy and create a meshed market between it. The result was First Solar. And what I think is kind of interesting about this is that there were some utilities involved at the time with CoLab. It wasn't them who saw the potential in this. It was actually a hardware startup and a financial service company that really had a lot of energy and wanted to get it done. And as they started to prove it out, the utilities got really interested. So it's just when we're kind of looking in our own backyard sometimes, or we're looking within our own space, we may not always realize the opportunities in front of us. It's going to take a different perspective to sort of identify what might be really interesting. So a way to practice this is think about a different type of expertise that could be interesting within a project. And you don't necessarily have to hire those people right away, but try working with them for an afternoon, just kind of collaborating on a new idea or building a new prototype. We usually see good things come of it. The fifth creative quality is empowerment. This is one that we get to as like a lot of, you know, hardcore business people. They're like, this is really the soft stuff. And it actually, even as someone who's been encouraging this for a long time, I'm constantly surprised like how impactful little things organizations can do on empowerment are on results. So driving change, a lot of people really focus this into little tiny groups, have elite design team, elite innovation team. And that's all good. Some things, some great new products and ventures have come out of that. But we see that the best organizations actually distribute these creative problem-solving methods and behaviors across their entire organization. They create a really transparent playing field where people understand how ideas get selected, why they get cut, what methods are to actually move ideas forward. And they understand how they can touch and how their ideas could come to life. So one of the most powerful metrics and insights that we found so far is just that when people within an organization feel that they can challenge the status quo, so if they can see things that the organization tends to defend or believe in or just, you know, be somewhat dogmatic about, that they can actually raise their hand and say, actually, I think this might not be right. I think we should explore how to do this differently. So when organizations can do that, the projects within them are almost 70% more likely to be successful. To talk about empowerment, I'm going to take us to Planned Parenthood, an organization I'm sure most of you are familiar with. Most people think of them as a women's organization, which is where they started, but today they actually offer primary and specialized care for 2.5 million men and women in the United States. And it's an organization with a lot of passion in it. There's a lot of passionate clinicians, there's a lot of really thankful and passionate patients. And a lot of this great work happens in environments that look like this, or at least they did. And what Planned Parenthood has seen and what IDEO saw after starting to work with them is that this has a real effect on the emotional state. As much as you may have great transactions, great doctors and the like, the environment plays a piece. And this is kind of reminiscent of the digital touch points as well. The thing with Planned Parenthood, though, is that it is actually an empowered organization, and it's actually consists of dozens of affiliates across the United States that are fundamentally, they are independent organizations. So, you know, they work together with a similar goal, but many have had their own innovations, and they've tailored their services to their local market, and they're proud of those changes. A lot of them are very successful. So we couldn't really, didn't make sense to do this top-down, like tell everyone what to do. And so we took a different approach, like what if we could harness all this, all of these people and all of this passion and actually get them to participate in scoping, this challenge, seeing what would have impact, submitting ideas, critiquing those ideas, and actually rolling them out. So thousands of people engaged from the start, raising their wish list, issues that they'd seen, new ideas for how to improve. This culminated in workshops that included hundreds from Planned Parenthood, but diverse array of people, architects, security experts, interior designers, thinking about how to make these ideas real and how to work within the various extremes of the Planned Parenthood clinics. One thing that came out of this is the Pacific Southwest region's affiliate had actually done a lot of human-centered design themselves. So they'd actually gone out and looked at dozens of analogous and interesting areas to get inspiration. And you know, one example of I think almost 10 different ideas that they had sort of activated was they had been inspired by Tiffany, where at the Tiffany locations, the security guards wear casual clothes and they welcome people and open the door. And it kind of, while they needed security, they you know wanted to meet the tone and the friendliness of their organization. So there were a bunch of these elements that you know if we had gone with a top-down approach, you know, they would have not been receptive. You're telling people who have done great work to throw that work away and do something else. And instead, this became a venue for their ideas to actually scale across Planned Parenthood. The end result was a kit. And again, the organizations could apply these to their own floor plans based on their own budgets, based on their own local needs, to roll those out at their own time. Many rolled them out full-fledged. And both those who did it partially and fully have gotten great feedback from patients about the emotional experience. And this work actually netted them a Fast Company Most Innovative Company Award in 2018, so we're proud of them for that. So there's a lot of different things under empowerment, but a lot of the time when we've seen organizations that are struggling with this, we really see that communication is the fundamental issue. And a lot of time companies are doing good things and people have touched those. They actually just don't know what's been going on. So opening up those communication lines, helping people see how their work is progressing is a great first step. So this will take us to our last creative quality, it's refinement. There's kind of this common mythology that, you know, there's this creative process and it kind of happens up front and you create these specs and requirements and then you just sort of implement it and you get, you know, engineers and the like to just kind of get it done. And we see time and time again, that's just not the case. There's a very small percentage of the overall problems that have been solved during that upfront creative process and all kinds of technical issues that can be the end of any great idea if they aren't well solved. So we see that great organizations, when they make room for problem solving and they respect the craft of the people to solve those and they create that thread of a vision through execution, those teams are 25% more likely to have successful launches. So for this, I want to take us to Peru. Several years ago, the CEO of Innova Schools in Peru, he saw a real challenge in the country and a lack of a quality education. So there are essentially two different sides. You could get a great education for kids for about $40,000 a year at top boarding schools and private schools, or you could use the free public education, which was consistently ranked at the bottom of the PISA rankings. And he wanted to create an affordable school for less than $100 a month that people, you know, trying to get into the middle class could afford. And he wanted to be high quality. So he started with a single school, and it was actually extremely successful. It had great scores in math, English, and sciences. By the time they got to four schools, though, the system was starting to break down. They weren't able to find enough qualified teachers. They didn't have a suitable teacher training program. Technology was getting adopted in Peru faster, and they didn't have any kind of digital ability. And the economics were changing. They couldn't get land at the low prices that they had gotten. So the economic equation of the schools was breaking down. And they brought in IDEO to try to make this model scalable. So we started by just seeing like what was really excellent about those original schools and where were they really knocking it out of the park. And the first thing that's really important when you're trying to scale and to create something great is just like really list down what is essential. What does your organization have to be really great at to achieve? In their cases, it was that the kids were great at problem solving and could start to self-teach. It was that they focused on socio-emotional curriculum. It was a great choice for parents because it respected their time and resources and it was convenient for them. So there's no way around the second part, which is once you know what you have to be excellent, you need to put time and resources into it. So they assembled a team for each of these with deep technical expertise in each area, but also with design expertise in these areas. And these teams are responsible for tracking the quality of these elements across their schools, looking for opportunities, prioritizing those opportunities on which are going to have most impact, and then implementing them. And the ideas can range. They can be small ideas. They found that in a lot of urban classrooms, loud urban environments, a lot of the kids at the back of the class couldn't hear. So they put little speakers at the back at a low cost, which helped with learning. As they also started to adopt technology in the classroom, they started to realize there were many different types of learning that were helpful to the students. At certain times, head-down self-learning was great. At other times, working in large teams in a more spacious environment. So we designed modular classrooms that actually move between these modes and support children in these different modes. This built them, instead of just being, again, a team solving a specific static problem in time, this turned them into an adaptable organization. So the system didn't break down. They would catch the issues before it would sort of be critical to the system. And this has now allowed them to scale to, I'm probably behind on this at this point, but 35 schools across Peru. And this model they've started to test it in Mexico as well. Students in these perform at like 3 times the level in maths and sciences. And they're, I think it's Fortune has put them as one of 3 benchmark schools across the world. So a recommended action on these that's, again, really an easy one is no matter what your team project or whatever it is you work on, is think about what does it have to be great at, what it makes, what gives it its character and its uniqueness and its value, and put those down as 5 to 7 design principles. And similar to purpose, like come back to those when you're making key decisions. So I've shared these 6 creative qualities with you. And each of them has material impact on team performance. And a lot of these aren't really a super high level of mastery, and they're not that difficult to do. So getting some of the basics in each of these right, compared to teams who don't do this, and there's a lot of teams that just don't do this stuff at all, those teams are 3 to 4 times as likely to have a successful launch. And organizations that are truly masterful at this stuff get up to 5 or 6 times effectiveness. So it's interesting that, like, once we had identified these, I kind of reflected on IDEO's history and where these qualities had kind of played in for us. And empowerment was there from the start. It was kind of why David Kelly started the company, to have this sort of friendly organization where everyone could work on interesting things together and have an equal say. And he brought over that prototyping and experimenting mindset from Stanford. And then they worked on the Apple Mouse. They created hundreds and thousands of different versions of it as they went. And so these things were kind of baked into our DNA. But looking out had to be learned. It was a struggle for a year to even get buy-in, and then it was a capability that had to be built over several more years. And we had to constantly diversify. Originally, it was really a company of engineers. But to tackle all these different challenges, we had to invite new people into the process and teach them how to design and increasingly diversify, like, the people that made up IDEO. And at a point, in order to find new interesting growth, our CEO, Tim, had to come back and rethink our purpose. He didn't completely pivot it, but he added that notion of disproportionate impact through design, which is fueling a lot of new and interesting initiatives like Creative Difference today. So with that, I just want to advise or suggest to people that, you know, there's probably a lot of these things that your teams are already doing well. Don't take it for granted that those are just going to stay that way together. Each of those strengths is a muscle that needs training. But also think about what your improvements might be. Which of these focus areas could help move the needle for you? And really focus on improving those. You know, we can see that the effects of these can be multiples in performance of teams. So thank you, and I'll take questions. Any questions? I can't see the, but there's a mic.
Hi, David. Thanks.
Hey.
I'm wondering tactically how Planned Parenthood scaled, because they're distributed across the U.S.
Yeah.
And that's always the challenge. Like, I work for the YMCA. We have a ton of people who want to collaborate. How?
Yeah. I mean, honestly, it was really voluntary. I mean, they were included in the solutions, and a lot of those ideas were actually coming out of those locations, and many of them had actually been proven out on the ground. So ultimately, I mean, the kit allowed them to do it at their own phases. So they didn't actually have to take it on all at once. And they didn't even have to do it even in this sort of over, you know, I showed that picture at the end that was this very specifically, you know, designed to the T version. But there were actually even versions of the kit of like what IKEA furniture you could buy to make the same thing, or what was the idea in principle. So you could actually just, you know, move around what you had and sort of create a similar experience or layout. And so no matter what the different sort of budget or needs or you know, whether you needed all the solutions or just one was really impactful, each location could actually roll it out with its own volition.
Was the initial information gathered by focus groups, online surveys, emails, conference calls, like all of the above? That's what I'm trying to figure out, is how you mobilize all of those people and gather their inputs.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think they used a few methods in this. I mean, there was definitely a group that was going location to location, actually like in person working with them. We frequently use a few different sort of open innovation platforms to gather input and make it easy to kind of move these ideas through phases and evaluate them and the like. I don't remember specifically if we use that for this, but we frequently do use it for this type of challenge.
Okay, thank you.
Cool, thank you. Hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good.
Really good. I was taking notes and, you know, 69% increase on empowerment. I took a note of that for sure. And then what did you say here? You said provide autonomy and clarity of process. Hmm. And immediately my brain went, whoa, do those compete with each other a bit? Or how do you,
yeah,
like, if, especially if your processes may be complex, or if a part of that process includes certain levels of standards, right?
Yep.
So now that you want to make that simple so people can be, have that autonomy, how do you straddle that? You know, can you speak
sure
to that a bit more?
Yeah, for sure. And to be clear, the stat was for challenging the status quo only, although that was the definition of empowerment. Yeah, so it's a great question. Obviously, there are like mission critical systems that need to be executed in certain ways. For a lot of like change work particularly, I think this is one thing that happens. A lot of organizations kind of fail to see the difference between those. And sort of making a really clear line between these are like mission critical processes and these are more suggested processes to get things going. And while I do definitely encourage that organizations are kind of flat and transparent and clear about like how they're making key decisions, in between, we actually advocate quite a lot more for like methods and tools rather than a pure process. There's a difference there, which it's not like a paint by colors, like first you do A, first you do B, then you do C. It's a little more like, well, what kind of question are you posed with? And are you arguing about the value proposition? Are you doing this? And then here's a tool that you could use to help solve that, right? So organizations that try to overly formalize the like creative process usually kind of struggle with that. And they actually end up doing themselves harm because they're actually taking a lot of the good judgment of the people out of that process.
Is there a level of governance that comes into that, though? I mean, I guess that's...
It might or it might not. I mean, it depends on the phase. You know, I think, early on, I think it's okay to let people, you know, have sort of free reign over light early prototyping methods. At a certain point, I think, you know, real time and resources come into those decisions. And then I think that's a point where you definitely need some type of governance to be like, well, who's getting the $100,000 or $1 million checks? So it really depends, I guess, really on like kind of the risk involved and the resources involved and the like. But I think none of those really necessarily exclude transparency as a core value on that. And that's a huge way that people understand that things are fair.
Yeah, and I would imagine scale is a factor there too. So if you know that autonomy is speaking to a large, consistent global audience, then the way you might design that might be a little bit different than if you're just dealing more locally.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's hard to make room for it, and that's another issue. Is like, you know, a lot of organizations are so, you know, minutely, everyone knows what they're doing every minute down to the, and that has to be loosened as well if any of this is going to happen. And that's a tough one.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Cool. That's helpful.
Cool.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Hi. Thank you for the presentation.
Thanks.
So, if you work for a large organization and you're coming in, or if you're coming in to engage a large organization, how do y'all start that process? Do you do a lot of education, kind of upfront? Here's what design principles are, or do you just jump into it and say, let's just get the activity going so we can start the process itself? And then the second part, if you could, are there some free, easy to use tools that smaller groups could just use off the bat that you could recommend?
Cool. Yeah, I'll try to answer those. So the first one, yeah, I mean, there can be a little bit of education. We try not to be too educate-y. I mean, that just bores people, and, you know, frankly, most people don't want to hear that. Yeah, definitely show by doing is a great practice. I think it's good to be quite, you know, for whatever the scope is, sometimes it's across a whole organization, sometimes a business unit, sometimes a team. It is good to be just really clear about what the intent is, you know, like, and combining a combination of like, here's what we're trying to achieve out in the world, and here's what we're trying to achieve inside our walls in terms of our organization and culture and process. And as much as the leaders can kind of have a narrative around that, that's really helpful. And then as soon as possible, yeah, I mean, it's just show by doing is the best way, you know, particularly the looking out stuff and experimenting stuff, like the power of that can be seen really quickly. And it's a great way when people are a little like skeptical, or does this stuff really work? And you get them in the field and talking to somebody and thinking about new ideas, and like, it's just engaging and people kind of run with it. So yeah, I think trying to get to show rather than tell as soon as possible. Oh, easy tools. Free easy tools are, so IDEO.org has, I think it's called Design Kit. I think they have a website that's free. And then we have a number of others. If you go to our IDEO.2/products, there's a number of, not free tools, but some of them are pretty affordable. Thanks.
Hi. So I'm part of an innovation group in a hospital setting. And one of the things we debate and talk about a lot is how you measure success, especially at the very early stage. So all your numbers were up there of increasing likelihood of success. How do you define success? How do you measure that, especially given that, you know, do you wait for a spin out or do you have $1 million in revenue? But I'm guessing you're kind of earlier on in that to like launch a product or some other metric. So good dive into measurements of success so that we can go back and pay for it.
I mean, that's a pretty like personal thing for every organization.
What was your definition of success when you gave those numbers?
Oh, yeah. So there were actually multiple so each organization would define their own. So the most common ones were new successful ventures, new profitable ventures, and newer, more efficient systems. And there were a few other stragglers. So it's different. I mean, if we see external markets facing stuff, you know, just to give a little bit of a tangibility on this, companies that don't do those creative qualities well, when they're launching, they're like 3 or 4% likely success rate, right? So like almost a 97% success rate. So even if you're doing this stuff really well, you're probably getting up to 25-30% success rate. Internal projects have a lot higher success rate by default, but similarly, they can see market improvements. And after explaining that, I forgot what your actual question was. Yeah. Oh. Yeah. I mean, yeah, that is a good question. Yeah. So I think, I mean, one of the benefits of this tool that we've seen is like all of those ultimate like business metrics, they're always lagging by a significant amount, right? And there's really no way around that, right? I mean, it takes, especially if a team is learning this stuff, it's going to take them several projects, probably at least a year to get familiar with the tools. And then, you know, maybe if they're lucky, they're on the path of saying, if not, they're going to start on a new project. That might take at least a year or 2 years to commercialize. So, and then once it's launched, like, so it can be like 3, 4, 5 years till companies are showing their actual business metrics. And that, it can, unfortunately, it can be critical. Like, we've seen organizations, it's like, they've started to have a really great group, they've got their groove together, 3 years in, it's like, where's your revenue impact, where's your profit impact, and they can get cut off, and that happens. So, I mean, it's one benefit of this is, you know, these are leading indicators, they're not like market-facing indicators, but we can, we do have strong evidence that if you're working on these and you're improving these metrics, you're actually on your way to improve those lagging business metrics. You know, I can't say I love a lot of other, like, internal, like, I mean, Colab, who I talked about, they like number of prototypes. I think those are kind of interesting ones, and we haven't actually measured their correlation to, actually, that's not true. We kind of have proxies of that here. But those, you know, those are likely correlated, but a lot of this, like, how many ideas are you trying out, or how many ideas are you prototyping? I mean, a lot of organizations will do this. I'm not sure if those are, I'm not sure I advocate for them necessarily, though.
Hi, my name is Brooke. Thank you for the session. I work for Home Depot, and I lead the Design Sprint Scaling Initiative. One of the big problems we face, I guess, is the problem framing coming into the Design Sprint. Mm. Can you maybe just like say high level, maybe some things that you guys do from problem reframing?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it is an important issue because I do think you always need a problem statement to kind of get started. But often we find it's the wrong one. And so I think it's, you know, making an organization comfortable with that after looking out, that it's actually a good time to maybe rethink the problem you're solving to be addressing the most significant needs and pain points of people. So, I mean, it's a pretty simple thing, but I just say, you know, realize that an initial problem statement is just the way in, and that after some of those initial steps, you should be comfortable like backing off and rethinking what the most promising problem statements are.
Thank you.
Thanks. Any last questions? Cool. Well, thanks everyone. Appreciate you listening.